Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It's been a pretty rough year for swine producers.
Looking back at 2023, Mike Tokash is a Kansas State University swine specialist.
We've had a combination of things occurring on the economic front. First and probably foremost is prices have obviously gone up. Inflation has hit the cost of everything, just like it has for all industries, but it particularly hit the swine industry with not only the cost of all of the normal goods that they use, but feed cost is our biggest cost by far. It's roughly 60 to 70% of the cost of production. And so with high soybean meal and corn prices this year, the feed cost for producers was quite high throughout the year. And you couple that with a relatively low market price as compared to where the feed prices were at. So producers have really gone through a year of pretty sustained losses in 2023.
This is Agriculture Today.
Commodity prices over the last year are basically unchanged, right? We're talking about oil prices, despite the fact that they've just been selling off aggressively, are still relatively unchanged on a year-on-year basis.
Daniel Galli is senior commodity strategist with TD, expressing his broad optimism for commodities in 2024.
The same is true for the base metals complex, right? All of these commodities are very highly sensitive to global economic growth, right? This time last year, the world was thinking that a recession was fairly imminent. That still didn't pan out. You had China's reopening. You had all these bullish factors that were since unwound. And in fact, if you look at the situation in China, they've just been facing a downward spiral in the real estate sector, which is one of the most commodity-intensive consuming industries in the world. Yet prices are basically unchanged. So despite the fact that we're in a high interest rate environment, that global growth is slowing, commodity prices have actually shown an incredible amount of resilience here. And that actually is a structural supply story, which I think is important to be able to see the forest from the trees.
And when talking about a Fed that might lower interest rates or may go slow in raising interest rates, that's called a dovish dance.
Well, typically, a dovish stance from the Federal Reserve is very bullish for commodities. Firstly, it relates to global demand growth, right? So lower interest rates tend to stimulate demand in the future. But secondly, and this is particularly relevant in this case where we've had the most aggressive Fed tightening cycle on record, the cost of carry of holding these commodities for speculators or for commodity merchants out there that actually hold physical inventories is extremely elevated. Right. Your trade-off here is, if you're a money manager, is to buy, you know, a cash-like product that is yielding a very high rate of return versus paying to store and to finance that storage of a commodity. It's a very, you know, tough bargain. And despite that fact, commodity prices have still been resilient. So once again, showing the beginning of the super cycle having an impact on prices.
Could additional government stimulus in China be positive?
Over the last year, we've taken a cautionary tone, thinking about the fact that China's stimulus has been very targeted in nature. It hasn't been the type of broad-based stimulus that they've deployed in the past. They're wary of the debt trap that kind of stimulus has created in the past, and they've been looking for ways to avoid it. That being said, increasingly there is pressure on the central government to deploy fiscal stimulus package to help to provide at least a floor for the economy, which seems to be in a downward spiral due to real estate intensity that they have in their economy. So saving the real estate sector from that downward spiral is key to the central government, and increasingly you're starting to see signs that they're putting that in place. I will say this as well. The targeted stimulus that they have deployed over the last year has actually been very commodity intensive, far more than we initially anticipated. Right? If we're talking about the real estate sector, they focused on completing projects. That is actually very copper and aluminum intensive. The completion stage tends to consume a lot more of that than the beginning stages of construction. So even the traditional sectors there had received some support from Chinese stimulus. But increasingly, the targeted nature of their stimulus has focused on new energy sectors. That energy transition in China is really leading the way on that. And the amount of solar power generation that they've built up in terms of capacity over the last year has far beaten even their lofty central government targets for 2023. And we expect that that's going to continue to remain, notwithstanding the fact that electric vehicles are actually probably the biggest and most important sector that they're leaning on.
Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So I think when we think about this, that we think about the word sustainability, one of the things that I challenge all of you with when we think about that and where we are, again, that's something that really starts with profitability. That's one of the main pillars of that.
You almost can't turn around anymore without hearing the word sustainability. Randy Block is president and CEO of Cattle Facts.
And obviously being socially responsible, environmentally on target with what we're doing, being able to measure that and being able to tell the story. The situation is we talk about climate change, we talk about carbon and methane. Those are things that are not going to go away. And I would encourage each and every one of you in the room to be, collect your data. We don't know exactly where all that's going yet today, but it is coming. I don't think it's going to go away. So, again, be prepared, do your homework, and continue to move forward in those areas.
Back in February, started sounding the warning bell.
The one thing I do want to say to each and every one of you in the room is, you better be ready. We are going to see some, with these kind of supply shocks that we're going to put in the market over the course of the next 3 to 4 years, we're going to see unprecedented volatility. Unprecedented. We're going to see swings in here that we haven't experienced for a while. We've had markets that have really been pretty quiet in here over the last couple of years. Once we went through the COVID situation in the spring of the year, these markets have worked higher. They've gradually worked higher. But look at these. Look at the red line here on this chart and the green line. This is the spread between calf prices and fed cattle prices and feeder cattle prices and fed cattle prices. They've been pretty flat, haven't they? Once we came through 2013, 14, 15, when we had the big spike, they've pretty well flatlined. What are those going to look like as we go down the road? I mean, it's going to get pretty wild. It's going to get pretty wild. We're going to see unprecedented price spreads in here on all these different classes of cattle. I don't think there's any doubt about it. This will give you a little bit of perspective what I'm talking about. If you'll focus your eyes on the bars that say 160. As an industry, we basically have been buying cattle to break even right around 160 here over the last several months. And with cost of gains at about $1.30 to $1.35, where we've had a lot of cost of gains here recently, that would suggest the break-even purchase price on an 800-pound steer is about $1.80. If cost of gains moved back to $1.10, look how we moved that needle. They're at $1.95. Now fast forward with me. Think about Kevin's outlook over the course of the next few years. Let's assume we start buying break-evens up in here closer to $1.80. And cost of gains are still at $1.30. We've got 2.15 feeders instead of $1.80 like we've got today. We've got cost of gains that have moved back in here, as Mike suggested, as we get into the fall of the year and we start to see some moderation in grain prices. Again, you can get cost of gains. You can start to see some tremendous price spreads in here on these feeder cattle. So this is the time in here that I would really encourage those of you is that you're really going to need to pay attention. When these markets move, they're going to have significant moves. They're going to create opportunities for you to lock in some solid profits on these different classes of cattle that you're working through. But you're really going to need to be attentive because these things are not going to be, they're not going to be tame.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So how is it that we're spending, these large sums in, 26, 27 and beyond?
University of Illinois Ag Policy Specialist, former FSA Administrator Jonathan Kappas.
And a lot of it is due to how the price loss coverage program works. And that is Congress sets a fixed price. Let's take wheat, for example. Wheat's reference price is $5.50. If during the course of the 12-month marketing year following wheat harvest, the national average price received by farmers is below that $5.50, we trigger payments. And so when CBO does their calculations, they estimate, they use USDA forecasts and others to try to get an estimate of where prices are going to be over this long, long 10-year window. And here you can see in particular wheat expected to be below its reference price in the out years, so 26 and beyond. And that's triggering a large amount of those payments. Soybeans, by comparison, is expected to stay well above its reference price of 840 and likely not to trigger any payments. Corn's a little bit closer to that reference price, so it's feeding some expectations of spending there, but not a lot. By comparison, looking at our other three major crops and major both in terms of acreage, but also in terms of the political influence, if you will, political footprint in these discussions. If we look at our southern crops, cotton, rice, and peanuts, we can see quite a bit of difference in the way the PLC program operates for these crops. So all three of them are expected to be below their reference prices in the out years. Now, again, this is likely to adjust when CBO re-forecasts. But peanuts, I think, is probably the one that jumps out the most. And it was projected in May to be well below its reference price. So the expectations in this program would be payments every year and large payments for peanuts, which if we take the expected outlays that CBO projected back in May and we divide it by the number of base acres that are in the program, this is what it looks like year over year, crop by crop. The main takeaway here is the importance of where that reference price is set. It's also a reminder of this baseline challenge because rice and peanuts are the smallest crops in the program. So if you increase their reference price, you can spend a lot more money per acre on those crops and those farmers who have base acres of those crops, but it doesn't show up in the baseline the same way. And this is, you know, a bit of a challenge for crops like corn and soybeans. Soybeans in particular, if we go back up here a minute, if soybeans want to move that reference price closer to where the forecasted prices are going to be, we're talking 50, 60 million acres potentially expected in that program, which is going to spend a lot more money in the baseline and be extraordinarily costly over a 10-year window. And so it challenges these larger crops under this baseline sort of zero-sum game that they cannot as easily increase the trigger points for program payments because they're paying out on such large acreage. And large acreage with payments over 10 years is extraordinarily expensive in the baseline. So this is, if you will, this is sort of a rough perspective around some of the politics at the committee level in particular, around how these programs are created, how we negotiate things like the fixed reference price and the statute, kind of who wins and loses in that undertaking. And certainly, you know, these politics break out on the regional lines because the southern crops are getting these larger payments every year. And, you know, their membership is more likely wanting to protect that or improve that. And so these are some of the indicators of the political challenges that we'll see at the committee level in particular. A lot of this won't get worked out on a floor debate because it's pretty deep in the weeds of the policy, but it certainly is something that the committees will work a lot on.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Yeah, I think some of what came to pass was what we expected. And of course, as it's been the last 3 years, there were plenty of unexpected turns.
Kevin McPartland is head of market structure and tech research for Coalition Greenwich.
So the first thing we knew was coming, we didn't know what it would look like. We set to watch out for whatever the next tail risk was. So we certainly saw some of those, thankfully, at least from a financial markets perspective. The ramifications weren't maybe as big as they could have been. So think SVB, obviously continued geopolitical sort of risk around the world. Would rather have not been right on that one, but certainly tail risks are still out there. And I think something we'll still think about next year. We also talked a bit about the importance of capital to the market. We see that the Basel III endgame sort of coming, right? And what will that mean for how banks allocate their capital and the cost of capital and the impact that ultimately has on the buy side. And of course, product selection and clearing. So capital was a big one and will still continue to be a big one. And then the last one I would bring up is crypto. So we were coming into 23 just having found out about FTX. Very sort of negative in the short term for that market. But in the long term, it does feel like we're sort of washing out everything that really wasn't fit for purpose for the long run, as it turns out anyway. And what's left is a core sort of infrastructure where there's a lot of room for growth. So interesting year. Some, as I said, expected, but plenty other of surprises.
Tim McCord is global head of financial and OTC products at the CME Group.
We continue to be in this age of uncertainty with respect to risk management. The need for clients to manage their risk is only increasing. And frankly, what we've seen by some of the events earlier this year, whether it be SVB or some of the other tail risks or the ongoing macroeconomic and geopolitical uncertainties, is that the cost of not hedging or sort of the cost of being wrong is only increasing. So that's certainly something that we've seen on our side or remains top of mind for clients. And certainly capital efficiencies and regulatory reform, that's an ongoing undercurrent that we've seen. But I think as we get more precise about in this environment of capital increasing in cost, that's only going to be more and more important over the coming years. And when we look at the next wave of regulatory reform, whether that be clearing or endgame or whatever it might be, the market has shown it can digest this, but it requires, you know, transparent conversation, a tremendous amount of dialogue. And certainly crypto is keeping everyone on their toes. So I think I agree with your point that it's cleared out some of the underbrush. It's some of the life cycle of this new emerging asset class, but still optimistic for what it holds in store for us.
Mick Partland on AI in trading.
We can't not mention AI. It feels a little obvious to say it, but it is true. I feel like I believe in the impacts of AI more than I have some of the other sort of buzzy tech that's come to the market over the last 10 years. One of the interesting things that feels very now and hands-on with AI is if we look back 20, so we look back when we started our careers, there was a lot of sort of command line entry coding. DOS was kind of in the rear view by then still, but a lot of command line. We moved to GUIs, we moved to touch screens, and it almost feels like generative AI is going to almost bring us back, right? So if we want to do an advanced search, today what's common is you click boxes, you do some filters, and you hit search. Now what we're going to do is type it out in plain English and get the same, probably better results than we were getting from the GUI. So interesting that it's this amazing new technology, but it really is almost bringing us back to our computer roots of typing into a command line.
Who knows, McCourt says AI could predict the future.
There are some things in past and maybe the future that will be done via mandate and sort of handed down. But you have this upwelling of capital improvement or capital efficiencies where people for commercial reasons or sort of optimizing their frontier of capital are making decisions based on things like UMR or regulatory capital or the way certain firms are handing down capital costs. So it's sort of this push and pull of mandate versus just optimizing your capital as a function of increasing profitability or preserving profit if you're maybe a commercial end user. And certainly AI is something that can't go away. I think maybe when we sit down in 2024, we'll be asking Gen AI what 2025 looks like.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Now we're going to transition into tighter supplies. Therefore, the packing community will have more leverage over the retailer, and we're suggesting more of those retail dollars will trickle back down to wholesale.
Back in February, Kevin Good with Cattle Facts talking about leverage in the cattle market.
And so we had retail up 1%. We're suggesting that wholesale will be up 4% for this year and resuming that longer-term uptrend that's been at 4.2% for quite some time. Wholesale had to pull back this past year. We got a little bit too stout as you go back and think about 2021. We would suggest as we move forward, and it's already starting to appear, with these tighter supplies, the floor is being raised in the carcass cutout. You can see our annual average forecast is basically for a 270, which would suggest that 250 plus or minus the bottom side, and something approaching 3 at the top side, it would be our forecast for the year. From a relationship between wholesale, the cutout, and fed cattle values, you can see that last year was a tremendous change from 20 to 21. To give you an illustration there, that's a 10-point move. 10-point move, that's almost $400 a head. And you think about fed values, we're up $20 plus, 100 weight. Despite the fact that wholesale was lower last year than the year prior, it's leverage. Leverage improved tremendously last year. We're suggesting it will continue to improve again this year and really over the next couple years. You can see the math that we've done in there. Our forecast for this year is going to be a 158 Fed market with a 270 cutout and a $15 drop. If we're at 158 for an annual average, and we're starting the year in the mid-50s, what does it look like from a seasonal standpoint? We are in a non-expansion seasonal. In other words, we've been liquidating. So in theory, over time, we're going into tighter supplies and should trend into higher prices, all other things being equal. If that's the case, your highs should occur again late year like they've done the last couple of years. We're suggesting here from our base in the mid-150s that we push into the mid-160s for a summer high. We would have the risk of coming back between 150 and 155 for a summer low and finishing the year somewhere close to 170 to get to 158 average. That's the way we would lay out the Fed market. If that's the case, looking at the feeder market, We're suggesting in here that we move another notch higher compared to where we were last year and end up averaging somewhere closer to 195. That might sound like a reach from where we're at today and where we've been, but think about where the deferred futures are at. If you go from the DEIS of this year on into the Feb and April of next year, we're already in the mid to upper 160s, pushing 170 in April of 24. Mike talked about corn prices moving lower through the second half of the year. You do the math there, it's easy to get a yearling market this fall at 210, 215. Very easy doing the math there. On the calf market this year, we've got it between 2 and 250 with the 2.25 average. Obviously, headwinds that we have and continue to face are input cost. The value of our calves as we go through this year and forward are going to be higher. We recognize that we're going to have economic incentives to expand the herd. It's not only just feed, it's higher values as well. We're optimistic we get the higher values. Unfortunately, some of the input costs are still going to continue to be somewhat of a headwind. On the cull cow market, you can see that we've got forecast to be another $20 a hundredweight higher. Rearview mirror, the cull cow market has been trending higher since 2018, with strong hamburger demand as a big driver despite the big supply of the big kill. We're just suggesting that we'll continue to push forward. And obviously, if we're going to have a high somewhere between the $1.10 and the $1.15, the summer months are the best bet for that to occur.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
And what is critical about baseline for a farm bill is that under the statute, under the federal budget statutes, CBO is required to assume the bill as it currently is written, does not change for 10 years into the future. And then they model all of this expected spending under that statutory outlet or that statutory scheme, assuming no changes.
Jonathan Kappas is a farm policy expert with the University of Illinois, former administrator of the Farm Service Agency.
So we're looking at roughly $120 up to $130 billion a year. So in a 10-year budget window, that will come out as a $1.3 trillion price tag. But again, remember that's 10 years. That's not $1 trillion every year going out the door.
And just reminds that raising revenues is not an option.
What is critical about this, as anybody that's dealt with recent farm bills knows, the baseline is the budget the committees have to work with. And under budget rules, they are required to stay within this baseline. And so any changes to statute will be scored by the Congressional Budget Office, and those changes have to be offset. So that means you have to cut other programs to offset increased spending. Used to mean you could raise revenue if you needed to. The House has implemented new rules this year, this Congress, that would require cuts. So you cannot increase revenues in any way, shape, or form. So this really creates a zero-sum political game under the baseline. What happens if you want to spend more money on Title I payments? Well, under the rules, you're going to have to cut something else. You have to cut within the jurisdiction of the committee, and that means you're going to have to likely look at either SNAP, crop insurance, or conservation as a source of offsets. And of course, the politics of that are, well, rather challenging.
He also talks about why the 2018 Farm Bill was so unique.
Certainly adds some uncertainties around what this Farm Bill debate looks like. So in August of 2022, Congress passed through budget reconciliation procedures, which allows them to bypass some of the rules, such as the Senate's filibuster and 60-vote threshold requirements that really can bog down legislation. But it means it passed on a party-line basis, and it was signed into law in August. It was a massive bill with funding all across different areas. There's a lot of focus on climate, healthcare, and some tax policy changes, but tucked within this is something very important for the farm bill. And that was what you see on the screen before you. So for fiscal years 2022 through 2025, the Inflation Reduction Act appropriated large additional amounts of funding for EQIP, for CSP, for the easement program, and the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. The total appropriation exceeded $18 billion over this time frame. This is not baseline funding. This was a separate appropriation. So we have these programs. They have permanent funding through the Commodity Credit Corporation. That's in the solid bars there below the programmatic levels. That is baseline. The Inflation Reduction Act provided this additional appropriation. It's a multi-year appropriation. The authority extends through 2031, so they have time to spend it. But it is not a baseline change. And so CBO will not be considering that in the Farm Bill baseline for 2023 looking forward, which means it also is not part of that baseline negotiation and calculation the same way. So I want to be clear that this additional funding exists on top of or in addition to the baseline funds in a Farm Bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
A year ago, we ventured into the roadshow concept with hosting both virtually and in-person informational meetings around the whole farm revenue protection and microfarm policies.
Marcia Bunger is administrator of USDA's Risk Management Agency.
So this year, we decided that we needed to do something similar with livestock products. While livestock products in the last couple of years have grown exponentially in usage, there still seems to be quite a bit of areas of the country that are not as familiar. So what we plan to do with our roadshow is not just focus on one product, but a whole cadre of products around livestock and giving the public, particularly the livestock grower, crop insurance agents, more information just to make sure that everyone is aware of all of the tools that they can have in their toolbox.